Hi, my name is Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
He's expecting a lot of progress in 7 days, I think, which was the last time he heard me actually speak. Oh, thank you. Makes it nice and romantic. Oh. I wasn't expecting to be speaking tonight. Today's one of those days in sobriety that was truly tremendous. And that's because we attended the graduation ceremony this afternoon for my middle child. So I've now clocked 2 out of 3 high school graduates. And we took pictures of the youngest with the cap on just in case she doesn't make it. So I can lie and claim 3 of 3 somewhere. But it was a nice gentle day. You know, we got up and we got ready, and some family canceled, so we asked other family to come, and they were able to at the last minute, which was nice. And we all sat together, and we all beamed together, and we all took pictures, and then we all shared a meal. And I got to tell you, coming from where I come from in my family's history, or probably not my family's history, my history with them, that's really amazing. Because my dad was there tonight. My dad and I are best buddies, and my dad and I didn't speak for years until I came in and started getting well here. So it's pretty cool. I have a lot to be grateful for today. So I guess I should start by reminding everyone, just in case you've forgotten, I don't speak for all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there's members of my home group here that think I do, but I don't. So I'm just here to tell you what it was like for me and what happened for me and what's worked for me. So that's it. And if you don't like what you hear, then I encourage you to go to other meetings and wait, because I'd been around in the program a little while before I actually heard Sean speak. And Sean and I shared a lot of the same insanities. And even though he's a guy, he told my story. And it happens to everybody, I think, if you come around long enough. I grew up in a I think a typical family, pretty average, nothing special, no big horror stories, no huge abuse. We weren't poor, we weren't rich. I don't remember any alcoholics in the family. I didn't have any friends who talked about alcoholism in their family. It was sort of an unknown thing for me, except for one uncle. My Uncle Paul, who was an alcoholic, but my family hid that from us. We all thought he was crazy. That's what my family told us. And he was a little bit. I didn't realize it until I actually met him in Alcoholics Anonymous years and years after he divorced my aunt. But Paul was somebody that I related to. Paul was that guy who would come to Christmas dinner, and after dinner we'd all be sitting around as kids, and I'm talking like when we were 6, 7, 8 years old, and we'd be playing Monopoly, and when it didn't go his way, Paul would flip the board and walk out of the room. And the family thought that was terrible behavior in front of the children, but I totally understood where he was coming from. 100%, I totally got what that was about, because I did it too. He just usually lost his patience and did it first. But that's all I kind of knew. I knew that my family drank, and it wasn't didn't seem to be a huge problem. So later on, when it started to become a problem for me, I didn't really understand why. And I guess because of when I grew up, when there was a lot of talk about drugs in school, and there was a lot of public information available, and people would come in a couple of times a year to talk to us of the dangers of drugs, that always made it seem like if you smoked pot on Monday, you'd be a heroin addict by Friday, and it wasn't your fault, right? Because like you'd get caught by this evil thing, this substance that would take you away. Booze to me was different. Nobody talked about it. But I started realizing when I started knowing I was getting into way more trouble than my friends, and it was costing me more than it was costing them, that there was something about me that was different. And I didn't have that same ability to blame the substance. I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought that it was because I was weak or because I was bad. And I carried a lot of shame for my drinking because of that. It also made it a lot easier for me to admit my drug addiction later on than it did for me to admit my alcoholism, because I didn't think addiction was my fault, but alcoholism certainly was. So, I don't remember my first drink. I remember going out. Actually, it seems like when I say that at meetings, usually somebody comes up afterwards who does remember a drink earlier, so I don't even bother trying to figure out when that first drink was. But I know that when I first started going out with friends and drinking heavily, the feeling, and I drank heavily from the first time I went out, I was overwhelmed with this sense of well-being. You know, I grew up as a kid not feeling like I fit in or I belonged anywhere. I was one of those kids that really liked structure. I wanted my day to go the same every single day. And when you threw things in, I was not spontaneous, and I didn't handle that. I liked to know where I was going and what was expected and what was going to happen. And when things changed, I had a bit of a fit, and a lot of a fit, early hissy fits, I suppose. And it didn't get me as much as they get me now. But and the other thing was I didn't know how to relate to people very well. I had a really hard time making friends. My mom will tell stories about how I used to only get invited to birthday parties when I was a little kid. It was because my sister got invited first, and mom would call the other mom and say, okay, Deborah can go, but Karen has to go with her, you know. It probably didn't help me a lot to know that. That didn't make me feel very popular. But that's the way it was. So when I started drinking and I started all of a sudden feeling like I belonged, it was huge for me. You know, I'd been an English Protestant kid in a French Catholic school where I was different. And then in high school, my parents switched us over, and all the English kids thought I was a frog, and that was kind of rough, and things were just always jumbled up. So when I started going to the discotheque, and I started finding when I drank, I was funny, and people seemed to like me, and they wanted to be around me, and I could cut loose and relax. It was truly a revelation. And I felt like I'd arrived, like this was the magic thing I'd been waiting for. And I spent the next several years chasing those moments of bliss. That's the only thing. It was almost a religious experience when I drank. For that little bit, there'd be like the getting to that moment, and then there'd be the, oh God, I'm way past it. And that sort of learning how to adjust and learning the do's and don'ts. The time I came home drunk and I wolfed down a huge glass of ice cold milk and a couple of donuts and I threw up the whole way up the back stairs. And you'd think the lesson there is don't drink like that. The lesson for me was no milk and donuts after drinking. And then it was don't eat spaghetti before you drink. And then there's, you know, the drinks that you do and you don't mix. And then there's the drugs and the drinks that you don't mix. And then there's the ones you want to mix because that's a really good thing. And there's the people you want to be around and the ones you don't. And slowly I sort of chose a path for myself that involved a lot of heavy drinking and bikers and working in clubs downtown, working on racetracks all over the West and down in the States. And it became a really violent, really confused, really horrific kind of lifestyle. And towards the end, about a year and a half, I guess, before I got sober, I remember we were racing horses down in California, and we'd be getting into cars, and the guys would have mason jars with them filled with whatever the booze of the day was for them. And I'd be sitting on the hump in the back of a Mustang going from Sacramento down to San Francisco thinking for sure we were going to be in a car accident, and my fear was that I would live. I became really afraid that I would live. And when I came back from that, I tried to quit drugs, and I did, sort of. The way I guess we tend to do without a program. What I meant by quitting was that I didn't do the same drug more than twice in a row. Codeine was off my list, but everything else was fair game. I tried a lot of things for the first time in that year and a half. But the drinking had always been out of control, and it still very much was. And I started going through things like delirium tremens, and I started noticing that my body felt like it was breaking down. I had a five-year-old at the time, and I would get on the floor. We had shag carpeting, and I'd get bruised playing on the floor with her, you know. And it's not like she was being rough. I couldn't lie down on the floor and not be bruised. And I'd get on the metro, and I'd have to hug the wall in the subway platform because there was... See, now, nothing was my fault to this point, right? It's not like I was suicidal. There were evil things down there who were going to try and pull me in and cause me to jump. And I couldn't go near the edge of the platform because if I did, something would pull me in. It's kind of like the way I used to ride in cars. I would ride sitting outside the passenger door of the car at high speeds, waiting to fall out going around the corner, which didn't happen, which sort of disappointed me. But I wasn't very proactive when it came to killing myself. I was also very disappointed that it hadn't happened yet, because I really, I don't know. At the end, I just wished I could have a nervous breakdown, because I thought it would make my brain stop. I thought I would stop thinking if I had a nervous breakdown, and I would have some peace. So there I was, 23, and beaten and broken and bankrupt and feeling like an old worn-out shoe, stinky, and probably with holes in it and stains and the kind of thing that you would wear around the house to do your housework, but you wouldn't want to be seen out in public with. That's how I felt as a human being. And my mom joined AA. It was a huge revelation to me. My mom was a member of church groups. She did. It seemed at times she did nothing but make crafts for church bazaars, and she was a great hostess and a baker, and did all kinds of things. I thought she was sort of perfect, you know, except I didn't like her very much growing up. I think maybe she was too perfect. But as an adult, things changed a little bit, and she'd spent a lot of time with me, and she told me that she was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not sure what I thought AA was exactly. I was certainly very confused about a lot of it. Certainly after I found out what AA was, I realized I was completely wrong. But I think I thought it was sort of like the buddy system, where you know, if you were 50 or so, you could go to this place, Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would hook you up with a buddy. That's what a sponsor was, right? A sponsor was this person who would follow you around and come unannounced to your house to check for empties and rifle through your garbage looking for bottles and stuff. That's what I thought AA was. And I was really glad my mom had found friends her own age. I can't tell you how relieved I was, because my mom was going through a divorce, and I'd already been through one. It was kind of old news to me. Oh, God, it was taking her a long time to get through this shit, you know. And she was coming to my house, and she was crying a lot. And I wanted her to go cry at somebody else's house, and I thought that's what AA would give her. Over time, my mom talked to me more and more about the program and alcoholism and what sponsorship was, and she sort of helped kind of unmuddle things for me. And eventually she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with them. And to her credit, my mom never once told me she thought that I had a problem with drugs or alcohol, which isn't like my mom. My mom's usually a lot more honest than that with me about what she thinks might be wrong. But she didn't say a word then. She just asked me to go to a meeting with her. And I didn't want to go. Why would I want to go hang out with my mom's friends? I mean, really, I was a hot 23-year-old, you know. I didn't want to go hang out in a church basement with 50-year-old losers. So I said no, and she started kind of playing into that arrogant notion I had about being my mom's protector. And she told me that she was going to this really rough meeting in LaSalle, and that there were a lot of men there who were sharks, who were wolves, and that, you know, she was going through a divorce, and she was kind of naive about men, and that she was afraid she was going to get hit on. And she explained to me about 13th stepping, you know, all these wild men you see in AA who go after newcomers and try and go to bed with them and then dump them, you know. And that appealed to me. The idea of being my mom's savior, actually the idea of being anybody's savior appeals to me. So I decided that would be my mission. I would go down to this meeting in LaSalle and I would save my mom from the AA wolves. And so I go to this meeting, and it was a nice meeting. It was. There wasn't a wolf there. But I sat there the whole night, keeping my eye out on Mom to make sure. And, you know, she knew everybody there. And I never once did I ever suspect that this was her home group, and that's exactly what it was. My mom had asked me to go and support her at her home group. And but it was, I guess, her way of getting my foot in the door. And after that meeting, this guy came up, and he looked as old as Sean looks now. He was an old guy with gray hair. And he came up to me after the meeting, and he offered me a meeting list, and I was totally offended. You know, I was half the age of anybody in the room, and I don't know, I thought I had it all together. I really did. And I told him that I didn't need his meeting list. I told him I was an addict, not an alcoholic, and I had no use for AA. I mean, what for? So he went away. And a couple minutes later, he comes back with the same meeting list, and this time he's told me that he's circled in it meetings where he thinks I'll find people like me. I wasn't really sure how to take that, right? But I wanted him to go away, so I took the meeting list. And I went home that night, and I went through the meeting list, and I answered all the questions on behalf of my neighbor, who was a Polish gentleman in his 50s who had a drinking problem. And he scared me. This guy had serious problems. So I answered the questions. He got out of, I think there was 20 then. I answered yes to 18 of them for him, and I stuck it in his mailbox, and I kind of forgot about it. A little while later, Mom asks me to go to another meeting with her. She needs more support, at least time for a meeting in NDG. Wilder than the ones in LaSalle, you know. Anyway, this went on for a little while, and gradually through talking to my mom and going to the meetings, I was learning things. I was learning things about what alcoholism is. I was learning that it was a disease. It's not a moral question. It's not a question of willpower or goodness or badness. This is an illness. And afterwards, especially through reading the big book, I learned more about it. I learned about the idea of it being an allergy. I learned that when I pick up a drink and I take that first one, I have no control. I have no idea where I'm going to end up. And the places I ended up when I was drinking proved that. I really don't know when it's going to end or where I'm going to end up, who I'm going to end up with. And I was already tired of saying, well, I'll never do that. And then a couple weeks later, I'd done it. And I had to go, oh, yeah, but I would never do this. And there's a limit to how low down your own sort of scale you can go. And I was pushing mine pretty low. So that's what I learned. I learned that it's a disease, and that once I pick up the first drink, I can't stop. I also learned that I have no defense against the first drink, and that's true to this day. If you put booze in front of me, my instinct is still to reach out and take it, because it's what I do. It's what alcoholics do. And this program, they said, would help me put a God moment in between that instinct to reach out for it and actually drinking it. And I found that today to be true. Whether it's the tools kicking in, whether it's getting my butt to a meeting, picking up the phone, whether it's saying a prayer, whether it's just remembering what I have to lose today, those are all things I couldn't do before when I was actively drinking. I never once reached out for a drink in a bar thinking, wow, where's this going to bring me? It was always, it's going to be different this time. I'll manage it this time. I'll control it this time. I'll go home to my own house this time. I mean, like, it was always going to be different this time, and it never was. It was always the same chaos. Now I have the tool. I've learned how to do that, how to think, wow, if I pick up this drink, where am I going to end up? What am I going to feel like in the morning? How much is it going to cost me? And I became unwilling to pay it. I guess more willing to go to any lengths to stay sober than I was willing to let this thing just take off with me. So somewhere in that space of time, I stopped drinking. And I don't know, it had been a week or so, and I went to a meeting with my mom around the corner, and I heard a young woman speak, and it was the first time I'd heard a young woman speak. She was in her early or mid-20s. And she talked about all the feelings that I was feeling right then and there. And she talked about them when they were gone, those feelings. The feeling of shame and remorse, of not being able to look yourself in the mirror because you don't like what you see staring back at you. And she was happy, and it showed. She was happy, and she was at peace, and it showed. And I wanted what she had. And I never saw her again. She moved away. But it was that night that I decided I was going to start going to meetings for me, not just to support my mom, and that I was going to try and learn the secret of happiness, because I still didn't really think I was an alcoholic. I think I still had it in my head that I was too young to be an alcoholic. And that's where the journey began. So that's where it started. Not big dramatic, no law enforcement, no doctors involved. There had been previously. But not in terms of recovery that I could relate to. I think there was something about coming to meetings here and knowing that the people in the rooms actually knew what it was like. I'd been in sort of professional sort of care of different sorts at different times, but it was never an alcoholic talking to me. The person talking to me about what I needed to do and how I needed to go about straightening out my life, they hadn't been where I was, and I didn't think they had any clue what they were talking about, and they probably didn't. But the people here knew all about it. And they not only knew how bad it had been, there were a lot of people here older than me who knew how bad it could get, how much, much worse it could get. And I certainly didn't. I didn't want to go there. So I stayed. And I followed suggestions. And they were simple at first, because I tell you, I came in here, I couldn't talk. When I first finally let go of booze and drugs altogether, I don't think I put a sentence together for the first month, which was bad because I worked in telemarketing then. They pulled me off the phones and stuck me in the accounting department doing bookwork because I couldn't speak on the phone. I couldn't talk at meetings either. I stuttered so badly, and I wasn't sleeping. I couldn't sleep for the first long time. But I also didn't know how to eat, and I didn't know how to wake up, and I didn't know how to get up and out of the house and dressed and work on time. I didn't know how to get to meetings. I didn't know how to do anything. I'd either forgotten or not learned half of it. I didn't know how to do anything. And I had to kind of slowly come out of the fog and learn how to do those things one thing at a time. And I don't even know what we started off with. But I know at meetings my first job was ashtrays. I had to wash ashtrays. And I did it here in the bathroom right back there. I washed ashtrays with another member, and it got me sort of talking to another girl. And from there, they stuck me on the door where I got to greet people. And I was afraid. I thought I would say the wrong thing and kill somebody because I'm still all powerful, right? And everything I do, like I was so afraid to go to this meeting with my mom once because it was right behind my house. And it wasn't all the neighbors I thought would know where I was going. It was my Polish neighbor. Because I thought that putting that meeting list in his mailbox was going to change his life. I thought it meant he was going to have to go to AA and he would realize it. And I thought if I went to that meeting, he would be there and he would put two and two together and figure out who'd done that. That's what I was afraid of. It was insane. So they stuck me on the door and they let me greet people. They let me greet newcomers and show them where the bathroom was and maybe show them the pamphlets and stuff like that and sit next to the new girls and show them how to wash ashtrays. And that's what I did. And it kind of went from there. And I learned more and more about my disease and about how to stay away from that first drink. And that's the key thing, I think, that I heard over and over and over again my first few months. I don't think it could have been drilled in any harder to me. It was this idea that I couldn't get drunk if I didn't take that first drink. It's the first drink that gets me. And I have to remember that. And so it was don't drink and go to meetings. It was don't drink and pick up the phone. Don't drink and clean the ashtrays. Don't drink. It was don't drink and the don't drink was really key. Because when I drink, I'm in a fog. I'm still in a fog sometimes. But then, I mean, I can't even believe how muddled my head was. I thought there were evil spirits in the metro trying to pull me in. You know, that's pretty muddled, you know. Today it's kind of like those days where when you live in the city and you get up and go, wow, it's a really gorgeous day, and then you head out over the bridge and you realize the city's covered in haze. My perception is still like that sometimes, you know. But at the time, oh my goodness, I couldn't tell. I used to have these dreams that I had a special visor, okay? I used to, because I was so confused about who I should trust and who I shouldn't. I used to have this dream I had a special visor and I'd be at a meeting and I would flip the visor down and people would be color-coded in the rooms. And there were certain colors for good people and certain colors for bad people I needed to stay away from. Like, I totally didn't trust myself. And I wanted those tools. I wanted a special magic visor that would tell me good people from bad people. Because I had such lousy judgments when it came to who I should be hanging out with. So, messed up. But it clears. And it clears by doing the stuff that's suggested. I got a sponsor who unfortunately always seemed to have the clear view of the city from the bridge. So it didn't matter what I came up with. She'd gotten to know me well enough that she could usually let me know when I was off course and when I was right on track. She could make solid suggestions to me about what I should and shouldn't be doing. And sometimes I listened and sometimes I didn't. And surprisingly, most of the times I listened, things turned out pretty good. And when I didn't, it turned out like when I was drinking. Because I make a big, huge mess of my life when I'm left to my own devices. And from there, we started working the steps. You know, and that was a really interesting challenge and neat experience that I don't feel like talking about actually tonight. I'm wondering how much time I have. Don't know. Okay, so look at your watches and don't tell me how much time I have. That's totally cool.
Not even nine.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Is it? Oh, cool. So, forgot what time the meeting started. Thank you. So, you'll get a sponsor, and your sponsor's going to tell you how to work the program. Because I think the deal is, I was told anyway, when it came to picking a sponsor, I was supposed to pick somebody who had what I wanted. And what I wanted was peace. I wanted happiness. I wanted freedom from the guilt and the shame. I wanted excitement. I wanted to party. So I found a sponsor who was able, apparently, to juggle all those things. And then the deal is you do what she does. And that's what I tried to do. I figured if you want what she has, you do what she did to get what she's got. So that's what I tried to do. And it worked out pretty well. And part of it, in the group that I belong to, and part of it with my first sponsor, involved service. And service, I don't talk nearly enough about it, but it's important to me. It's part of, I think, where I learned to try and live a spiritual way of life. In doing the first steps, I was really self-absorbed. It's all about me, my alcoholism, my powerlessness, my higher power, my inventory, my defects, my amends. It's all about me. And then gradually it shifts to become about other people and to start thinking about other people. And service was a big part of that for me. Sitting and doing a shift on the helpline where we answer the phone for newcomers or out-of-towners who are standing on street corners not knowing where the meeting is, is a total kick in the ass, I think, as far as service goes. It also taught me partly to let go, because when I do work on the phones, I don't get to see the results. So I answer the phone, and there's somebody who's in trouble or somebody who needs to get to a meeting. I never find out later whether or not I made a difference or not. I just have to have that faith that because I'm there doing what I'm supposed to do, God will look after the results, and things will work out. And I guess they do, because I meet tons of people at meetings who've called the phones and talked to somebody other than me who are here. So I guess it does work. And I started doing stuff in high school. So I was 23 when I got sober, and that was young enough that that kids in high school would relate to me better than they related to that old 60-year-old fart that used to come with it. And I started doing stuff like that and trying to help kids who were just getting into it, or kids who might be hitting their bottoms who had no clue, like I didn't have any clue, any notion that Alcoholics Anonymous was here for me at the age that I was at. And that was a really good thing. And slowly those things helped, I think, in two ways. They helped me feel like a better person, like I had something to offer, which is something I wasn't aware that I didn't have when I came in. I think when I came in, if you'd asked me what I'd lost, I probably would have talked to you about a trashed marriage, cars that I'd lost, jobs, things like that. I lost my sense of self. I had no clue who I was, and I had no clue that I had a higher power that I could turn to. I had no solution. And doing service helped me see those things. It helped me see that I could do something good for someone else. It helped give me a sense of purpose, but it also really enhanced my faith. You know, when I'm serving with other alcoholics, we all have one purpose. We don't always agree, and we don't always get along in committees and home group business meetings and all that other stuff. But I've seen how we can come together and do the right thing for the newcomer. And that's our purpose here. It's to help other people who don't know about AA to find out about it and come here and get well like we have. That's what we do. And I've seen so many people from so many different backgrounds and of different opinions come together. And I've never seen that anywhere else. I've been involved in lots of other things, and I've never seen that like I do here. And that helps enhance my faith that there's a higher power that we're all tapping into. It also helped me see that when shit hits the fan in my life today, the people generally that show up at my door, the ones who are willing to drive me and the kids to the hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning because somebody's hurt, the ones who will hold my hand for months and months on end when I go through a crappy divorce or I have trouble at work or all this other stuff, they're mostly people I've done service with. those are the ones that keep showing up and keep supporting me. You know, and that's a gift, I tell you. That's an amazing thing to have that kind of friendship. That's what I get through service. That also enhances my faith. Today was a great day, and I've had a really great couple of months. I think, despite my wicked reputation as a control freak who throws hissy fits, I can say that out loud and laugh about it with you, rather than getting all defensive. But I really tried hard in the last little while to learn how to let go and to pick my battles. There are things that are important to me, and a lot of things that just aren't. So I don't need to argue about most of the things that aren't anymore. And hopefully I'll continue to grow in that direction, because I think it makes me easier to get along with, and overall just like I'm a nicer person. And that's good, because that means I get more friends, or the ones I have will stay. And that's a good thing, a really good thing. But it also takes a lot of the pressure off me. Probably the only thing that time, continuous sobriety has given me is an opportunity to go through a lot of changes, a lot of joyous events like the birth of a grandchild or the graduation of somebody from high school, also to go through divorce and losing a house and illness and death and all that kind of stuff, and see that not one of those changes has killed me. Because I'm a bit of a drama queen too. I always think that, oh my God, I'm never going to get through this, I'm going to die. And I haven't. None of it's killed me. The strange thing is that all those things have brought me to a better place than I could have imagined being in. Which is funny for somebody who likes to take control and make things happen, to realize that when I don't, I end up in a better place than when I do. Is a big gift, I think, and one that I hope I can hold on to. But it's brought me really that peace that I've always been looking for. It's tremendous, the energy I put into trying to control everything. And I have that energy now for other things, like breathing and celebrating and walking and listening. So I'm in a pretty good place. And it's all because of what's in the book. It's all in the book, in the program, the 12 steps. So if you're new, I encourage you to stay and give yourself a chance. Stick around long enough to get to some meetings and listen to other speakers and see different kinds of meetings and find out where you might fit. Give yourself that chance. It's really important, and you're worth it. You're worth it to do that. And with that, I want to thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for listening.